It's Farmer Friday on Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Darren Hefty along with my brother Brian. We're broadcasting from the Morton studio, taking your calls and questions all throughout the show at 844-44-AG-PHD. Or you can always email us radio@agphd.com. Brian, we got a ton of mailbag questions that have come in. My goodness, there's a lot of people thinking about, what do I do? How do I make this last decision? Anything you want to talk about before we dive into that mailbag?
Nope. Let's hit it.
It's the mailbag.
All right. Jason up in southeast Saskatchewan has a drain tile question. He said, all right, I'm curious, will drain tile be able to move water as soon as the frost begins to come out? Or will my tile still be full of ice if there is a wet fall at the time of freeze up?
No, as soon as the frost comes out, then your tile lines will run.
Yeah,
that's been our experience.
It's interesting to see, you know, how deep the frost is some years it gets a little deeper, other years it doesn't. Some years tile could literally run all through the winter if the frost doesn't get down there. So if there's an excess of water to get rid of. Okay, another question. This one comes from BP, who says, all right, which one is better for yield, naturally drying the grain when it's still out in the field or harvesting at a high water content?
Harvesting at a high water content. Now, if there was a way that you could get it into your bin, well, there is a way. So let me talk about this. If there's a way you can take that out of the field wet, you have way less pre-harvest loss, way less harvest loss. And then when you get it into the bin, if you don't put heat on it, you just set it gently in the bin. You let air gradually take that moisture down. That's the best possible way you can do that. Now, we have always run heat to our grain because we're trying to make this go fast and dry it down. And so in that heating process, we might lose just a little bit. But our dad always used to talk about, and I don't know, you know, the science behind it, if we actually are able to do this, but he would say, hey, if there's any aflatoxin in there or anything, we'll kill that off by heating it. And I would heat, because I ran our dryers for 20 years, I would heat it to a real hot temperature. I'd get well over 200. So I did think that probably made a difference on that side of things. But yeah, you do not want to let grain dry down in the field if you want to maximize yield. Isn't going to happen because you're going to have more pre-harvest loss and more harvest loss for sure. I'll guarantee you. No question about it.
All right. Thanks, BP. I appreciate the question. Now, Brian, let me throw this one back at you, though. Let's say that BP is in a situation where he's in a third world country. They don't have the harvesting equipment. They're going to harvest it by hand. If you're harvesting ears by hand, that changes things up a little bit.
Yes, it changes it up somewhat because your harvest loss won't be as great, but you're still going to have pre-harvest loss. Everything from deer to birds to ears just fall on the ground, more disease, just everything can be a problem there. So I guess here's the other thing that I just wanted to say, as I was just talking about how, oh, we need to harvest corn wet. Look, we understand that if you don't have a grain drying setup, you have to have it custom done. Basically, you're going to haul to an elevator and they're going to charge you a lot of money to do that. You may say, all right, well, my harvest and my pre-harvest loss was not going to be more than what the drying cost was. So I do want to let it dry down in my field naturally, at least a little bit drier. But if you doubt any of this, please just do your own tests. I mean, it's a big deal. So that's why if you have a lot of acres and you want to raise a lot of corn in the future, we always encourage people, hey, get a good drying system so you can harvest the corn wet or have automatic bin fan controls or do something so you can take that corn in wet and then get it dried down yourself.
All right. Next question comes from John. And John, let's see, is in Minnesota. He said, all right, guys, I'm taking a closer look at fertility rates for sulfur on my crops, and I'm reading Neil Kinsey's Hands on Agronomy book. There it says it takes 3 pounds of sulfate to equal 1 pound of actual sulfur. If the sulfur recommendation from your crop removal or fertilizer removal app says I need 26.25 pounds, I multiply that times 3, that gives me 78.75 pounds of ammonium sulfate to appropriately feed my crop. Is that correct?
No. So the sulfur in element in ammonium sulfate, it's figured in sulfur pounds, not figured in sulfate pounds. So don't get too worried about it. You're fine. So just use the same conversion. The only thing you need to know is, hey, if you need 26 pounds, you divide it by whatever percent your ammonium sulfate is. I'm going to assume it's 24% sulfur. Take 26 divided by 0.24. And so, I mean, roughly you're going to need just over 100 pounds of ammonium sulfate, and that should give you all the sulfur that you're going to need. However, keep in mind, once sulfur converts over to sulfate, it's leachable. And if you're worried about loss, I don't know how much you're going to lose. In a light soil, you're going to lose some probably if you get lots of rainfall.
Okay, interesting question here. This one comes from Emerson. He said, I hear you guys have been to South America before. I farm in Paraguay. I'm just curious, do you think the farmland is better in North America or in South America?
North America is a big place. South America is a big place. So I don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers on which continent has more good crop land. But I will say this, we can make a lot of land good, but we are pretty lucky, like in the Midwestern United States here, where we have lots of dark soil that has plenty of organic matter, it's pretty rich, and we have good conditions, good weather conditions for growing a lot of crops most years.
Yeah, you definitely can be successful in both North America and South America. As Brian was saying, there's lots of good farm ground in both. Hey, thanks for the question, Emerson. Thanks for checking out our show, too. We really appreciate that. It's Farmer Friday. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Maverick Corn Herbicide from Valent USA has proven to be a key part of growers' success in fighting problematic weeds. But don't take it from us. Take it from agronomy manager Nate Honeck.
We've seen tremendous weed control that was sprayed in dry, hot conditions with very little rain within 2 weeks after application. Very easy application. Definitely tank mix well with the various products we used.
Visit Valent.com/Maverick to learn more about Maverick Corn Herbicide. Always read and follow label instructions.
My mom's got a new Case IH tractor and it can do it all. Bale hay all day. See in the dark with its powerful LED lights. Hook up all the implements. Shift like a race car. Steer with ease. And it can also cool my juice box. Yeah, her Case IH tractor can do everything she needs it to.
Looking for a tractor that can do it all? Check out CaseIH.com.
Higher yield potential starts with the season-long systemic disease protection of Xyway brand fungicides from FMC. Xyway brand fungicides protect corn crops from key foliar diseases and support physiological benefits that help develop healthier, higher yielding corn for a difference you'll appreciate at harvest. Visit your FMC retailer for an at-plant advantage. Always read and follow all label directions.
What's the difference between John, who bought Enlist One herbicide and Instinct Next Gen nitrogen stabilizer, and Tom, who bought Enlist One and Instinct Next Gen and used True Choice? Only about $5,000 extra in Tom's pocket? Choose True Choice and get up to 10% back. It's really as simple as that. Start saving at Corteva.com/save more.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio on a Farmer Friday. That means we're taking your calls and questions throughout the whole show. It's 844-44-AG-PHD, or our email address is radio@agphd.com. Let's head over to Iowa. Heck, the guys in Iowa are probably already starting to plant. Who knows? They're generally ahead of the game, and we've got Gary with us right now. Gary, how you doing?
Well, that might be true, except I'm in northeast Iowa, and we call it the frozen tundra of Iowa. So we don't get started too early.
That might be okay this year. I think a lot of guys are ready to jump the gun, and they're pretty excited. I just heard a weather forecast for our area, and they're forecasting potentially a big snowstorm or maybe a rainstorm 10 days from now. That might be just perfect timing to get some moisture and keep guys out of the field. That's about the time the early guys want to try and get out there.
There's been some oats going in the ground around here, even a couple of weeks ago. But just before this rain we had yesterday, we had a significant amount of rain, upwards of an inch. But we're still in that pocket. You take Interstate 35 and Interstate 80, and you take that northeast corner, pretty much all of it's well below moisture, well below normal in moisture. So it was welcome, but obviously the moisture we need is in June, July, and August. So.
You know, and the moisture that I like, too, is the kind we don't have to scoop. So I love hearing that you got an inch of rain. I bet it just soaked right in.
Yeah, it just rained all day, and it came slow. It didn't help the Mississippi. We're right along the Mississippi River, and it's quite low. So not enough runoff to help it, but it most certainly helped the moisture level in the fields. Yeah, this has been a nice winter. I mean, I can stand living in Iowa these kind of winters, but of course, wintertime snow, most of it runs off anyway. You don't get a lot of it in the ground. So, yeah, this is very good. And this early spring has been terrific for cover crops. We plant a lot of cover crops, and, boy, they're looking terrific right now. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. You know, and what a great year to have cover crops out there if you're going to catch some spring rains here to hold all the soil in place and just soak stuff right in. That's a nice strategy. What are you thinking for this year? Normal rotation for you with corn and soybeans, or are you switching anything up?
Well, we switched just a small amount to corn on corn just because our acres were getting a little out of balance. But basically, we always stayed right where we're at. We dairy, so we got to have X amount of acres for corn silage. And then we use rye as a forage source for the cattle, and then no-till beans in behind the rye so that them acres don't change from year to year. They just flip back and forth, and then that works into our manure management plan. I haven't heard a lot of people doing much switching. Up here, there is a fair amount of corn on corn grown, and a lot of anhydrous went on last fall, and dry as far as that goes, too. So it's going to be hard for some to do much switching around, I believe.
That is a great point, Gary, and I would say the same thing over here, too. There are a lot of guys that get out there in the fall and got everything done. So once they're all prepped and fertilized for corn, I don't see them switching either.
So are you an expert in two topics, one microbials and two carbon market?
Okay, well, go ahead. Shoot.
Well, start with microbials. How do you determine what will work and what won't?
You know, we do a lot of testing, and here's one of the neat things about that. I just got in a conversation yesterday with some North Dakota farmers about this. When you're talking about chemistry, it's pretty predictable. I mean, yeah, occasionally it doesn't work, but 9 times out of 10, you know exactly what it's going to do in various conditions. The microbial type products, boy, it really varies depending on organic matter levels, depending on temperature, depending on what you're going to mix with, all those things. So there are just several things that you have to do to make them work. One, if you have chlorinated water, this has been one of the big discoveries in the industry is, oh, I'm using city water or I'm using rural water and it has chlorine in it. And that chlorine, of course, is designed to kill living microbes and it does a great job at it. If you're mixing those things with your microbes, you're probably going to kill them. So we've seen guys going to the talc-based solutions. Some of those, especially talc-graphite combinations, if they're mixed for a long time with microbes, the graphite has been pretty hard on microbial survival. So it's important to know that you got good living product first. But then outside of that, just trying lots of products, trying them at different timings and really trying to follow the directions those companies have if they've done their research and they know exactly when the best outcomes are going to happen, just trying to follow those the best we can. So, yeah, we've ruled out dozens of them on our farm already. We've found, I don't know, maybe a dozen that work pretty well, and then we found 4 or 5 that we're just going to use every time no matter what. So it's taken quite a process. We've really been working on it for a long time here.
What about the N producers or N scavengers, whichever you want to call it, whether it's from atmospheric N or whether it's from soil biology, microbiology N?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that has been really the hottest topic here, especially the last few years. What we found with those is they all work. It's just a more expensive way to deliver N. And so it's not as cheap as what you can buy nitrogen fertilizer for. So that's one thing. The other thing is they really don't show up in your field unless nitrogen is the yield limiting factor. And for most farmers in North America, we don't want to run short of N. So we're not running that tight that those things make a big difference. But where they have made a really big difference, and like your area will be a great area to try this out, is high yielding soybeans. If you've got 60 plus bushel beans, that's where we see these things really pick up, because you just can't produce enough from your nodules on your soybeans. Once you get past 60 or 70 bushels, you need some additional N, and these things have really looked pretty good. So that might be a place to try them, is on soybeans this year. What we're kind of interested in on the corn are any of these biologicals or naturals, as we like to call them, that can help with the other nutrients. I think N we do a pretty good job on, but P and K and micros is where we often run short. And some of these microbial products have been pretty good at helping expand the root system, explore more soil, and find some of those other nutrients too.
So on soybeans, you're talking about like an Invita product that does the atmospheric N, or you're talking about something that actually works in the ground?
Either one. Yeah. We've found that they all have added more nitrogen. So we think they're fair on that. We just don't think it's 25 or 40 pounds or anything like that necessarily. And the pounds they do create cost more than commercial fertilizer. But in soybeans, a lot of guys aren't throwing out commercial N. So here would be a way where you could throw something in. I like the products that are more in the $5 to $10 range than the $20 to $30 an acre range. And we've seen those perform very well.
Yeah, the other thing, from our agronomist and some other farmers, a lot of sulfur, a lot of AMS going on ahead of beans. Everybody feels that they're shorting their beans on sulfur, so there's been a lot of sulfur application now going forward for the 24 season. So.
Yeah, sulfur has definitely been a hot topic. That one, I would say most farmers that I talk to are talking about sulfur, and a lot of guys have done some trial work on their farms and said, wow, the more sulfur I put on, the better. And I'm sure there's a limit to that. It's not like, well, let's just put on 10 tons of sulfur. I think you're going to kill things then, of course. But if you're putting on 50 pounds or 100 pounds instead of 20 in some strips and you're seeing gains on your farm, then absolutely, I'd go for it.
Yep. And the other topic I'd mentioned, maybe you don't have time to your break or whatever, but carbon market and carbon scoring in this area is a lot of talk because we're surrounded by ethanol plants. I don't know, is that a hot topic in your area? And if so, what are you doing to maybe capture that market?
You know, that's a great question. And we've got a lot of ethanol plants out here in our area too, and they're working on pipelines and all these kinds of things. So that's probably the biggest topic in that market right now. But for the farmers that have been looking at, hey, can I get paid for capturing carbon on my farm? That makes sense. In the past, there were some offers that were $3, $5, $10 an acre. And a lot of guys said, man, that's not worth the paperwork for that. But now there's some offers that are $30 an acre and a one-year deal. Well, if things are going to be a little tighter for margins on the farm this year, that might be something to look at. So we haven't done it yet personally on our farm, but it's something that we're looking into. And who knows, that might happen as soon as this year for us as well.
Well, it's going to be a learning year on the carbon thing, I think. So.
Yeah, it is, and for a while, I think. Hey, Gary, thanks for the call. We really appreciate it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Because the challenges you face are getting bigger every year, BASF is committed to helping with more than boots on the ground. We're committed to boots in the mud, boots on the steps of your truck, your tractor, your combine, the linoleum tiles of your coffee shop, the concrete of your co-op, the gravel in your shed. So we can listen, learn firsthand, help right now to ensure success. BASF, helping you do the biggest job on earth.
Your farm's greatest challenge is making sure your crop has enough fertility to reach its yield goals. But how do you know if you're applying too much of any one nutrient? Fine-tune your fertility plan with Verify. Your combine collects hundreds of yield data points per acre. Verify takes that data and instantly generates variable rate fertility maps based on crop removal, so you can be confident you're not over-applying. Get started today at verify.com. That's V-R-A-F-Y.com.
Maverick Corn Herbicide from Valent USA has proven to be a key part of growers' success in fighting problematic weeds. But don't take it from us. Take it from farmer Rob Schaefer.
Residuals have become a big part of our chemical programs with trying to battle water hemp, and also mare's tail is our big one. It's done a real good job of controlling those. You don't have to, you know, put a bunch of gallons in your sprayer, cover a lot of acres that way.
Visit Valent.com/Maverick to learn more about Maverick Corn Herbicide. Always read and follow label instructions.
It's smart to make the right agronomic choices, and it's even smarter to get rewarded for them. With the Bayer Plus Rewards program, you earn cash back on seed, herbicides, and other eligible products. And it keeps getting smarter, because now you can earn an additional 10% bonus when you send your redemption check to your retailer. To learn more, contact your retailer today. Protect your yields and get the most from your land with Bayer Plus Rewards. Visit mybayerplus.com and see program terms and conditions for full details.
Every season, you're collecting yield data on virtually every acre of your farm. But what good is your data if you never use it? Put it to work with Verify. Verify takes yield data directly from your combine and instantly generates variable rate fertility maps based on crop removal, ensuring your crops get what they need, right where they need it, no matter what equipment you run. Go to verify.com to find an expert to help you get started. That's V-R-A-F-Y.com.
Farming comes with trade-offs. An extra pass means dinner in the cab. An early morning becomes a late night. Unnecessary restrictions turn into headaches. But when you make Enlist herbicides the foundation of your herbicide program, the trade-offs will be in your favor. Effective weed control that's ready to work when you are. Flexible tank mix options and neighbor-friendly applications, all without the need to jump through hoops. See what you'll gain with America's most trusted herbicide system protecting your Enlist E3 soybean fields at Enlist.com.
It's Farmer Friday on Ag PhD Radio. We're taking your calls and questions at 844-44-AG-PHD on today's program. So don't be afraid. If you get a question or just want to talk about what's happening on your farm, we would love to hear from you. Got Rock on right now. Farms over in Illinois. How you doing, Rock?
Darren, wonderful. How are you today?
Pretty good. I'm getting antsy here. It's getting closer and closer to April, and that's when all the action really gets going here. We're doing a little bit of fertilizing and a couple things. Got some neighbors putting on some manure today, but it's still early. It's still the middle of March.
Yeah, we have a little bit of strip till to do yet. Some corn on corn under irrigation. We were going to do a little bit more, but I understand anhydrous has gone up somewhat. And as we've been talking about already, it's a matter of which crop are you going to lose the least amount of money on. So we might not look at those corn on corn acres.
That sounds like a veteran farmer. It's which crop are we going to lose the least on? That's starting to sound like farming about 15 or 20 years ago again.
You know, what I would really like to see, Darren, is if we would all just lighten our workload a little bit and let's just all lay 20% set aside and take care of this oversupply, over surplus situation that we're looking at. It'd get things back in tune again, wouldn't it?
It would do it in a real hurry, that's for sure. The other thing is, if we would just, instead of this 10% ethanol thing, would just say, you know what, let's just do 20 or 25 or 30 like they're doing in Brazil, and we'll wind it up real quick too.
You know, that is frustrating why our government won't work with us and help us utilize what we produce domestically. But, you know, that battle's gone on for quite some time.
It sure has. But, man, yeah, I think about all the small towns in rural America that have these ethanol plants that would benefit just tremendously. And, of course, it would just change a lot of things in the local markets. But I see things a little differently. If I was president for a day, Rock, I would have it all taken care of.
You know, we're very fortunate. We have an ethanol plant at Anawan, Illinois, 10 miles from my grain bins. And as you mentioned, ethanol has changed the rural economy, the jobs. That little kernel of corn is a totally different kernel than it was 35 years ago, 40 years ago when I started. So, yeah, what it's done to the rural economy, you can just look around. You can see the improvements on farmsteads. You can see the improvement in machinery, all the above. So we need to continue to push forward and try to promote our product.
For sure, for sure. Hey, you mentioned something early on here that I wanted to get back to is you said you're going to strip till in some corn on corn acres, or at least that was the original plan. What's been your luck strip tilling through corn on corn? Is that if it's silage, I could say, oh yeah, no problem. You don't have all the residue to deal with, but I think you're talking about corn you're harvesting for grain.
Yes, you live and learn every year, and it works a little bit better in the spring rather than the fall corn on corn, especially if you had a hybrid with really a tall amount or a large amount of residue. We ran into some plugging issues, but by the time that stuff firms up over the winter and you go between the rows, we've gotten along pretty darn good. And we've had our problems. We've had our beaver huts, but you live and learn, and I think we'll be a little bit better, so we'll be fine. And again, if you pick your hybrids that aren't 14 foot tall, it makes a big difference when you come in with that strip till bar.
Yeah, I believe it. You know, you think about all the work that got done last fall. Like you say, there's some jobs still to do this spring, but we're set up pretty good for getting out there fairly early. Are you guys dry in your area too?
We've been fortunate. I've been on assignment away from the farm for a period of time here, but I understand we've got an inch and a half to 2 inches of rain, and we're in pretty good shape. And that's another benefit of strip till, is you just go in there and plant right on that moist strip. You don't, we don't till full tillage anymore, you know, and lose that moisture that we did capture here recently. So I think we're okay. And anyway, we're looking forward to when the time is right, when we have the temperature, and that 3 mornings in a row to turn that planter loose. But now, as we talk about, we have to plant all our soybeans before our corn, so we're probably more focused on the bean planter right now than the corn planter.
Yeah, there's a growing percentage of farmers that are putting the beans in the ground first, and it's been interesting. I was just getting questioned up in North Dakota about this, and I said, well, it might be a little different for you guys as far north as you are, but when you go south, what we've been seeing, even in our part of the world, we're just seeing more nodes on those plants. We can get them out a little bit earlier, and that just gives us more potential. Doesn't always mean more yield, but more times than not, it does.
And the earlier the clock starts ticking on that growing little seed, whether it be corn or beans, the earlier you can get that combine fired up in the fall. And that's always a reward when you can finish early in the fall and not battle snow and cold temperatures in the fall.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. All right, so talk to us about your farm, Rock. You said you've been off on assignment here for a little while, I'm assuming in warmer places. So who takes care of things back home? Have you got the next generation coming up, or you got some other guys you work with back home?
Son-in-law guarding the fort back home. We don't have livestock anymore. Had beef cows for 33 years, but right now it's just delivering grain this time of year. The beautiful, pleasant winter we've had. We cleared a lot of trees off ditch banks, fence lines, whatever, and kind of eliminated the removal of the planter markers, you know, when you make that first pass along the fence.
Yep.
So burned a lot of brush piles, and Rob has been busy at home and anxious to go see what everything looks like and take a pass through the timber, look for shed antlers out in the timber, and can't wait to get there.
Yeah, you sound like the shark farmer now, going looking for those sheds out there. Hey, you mentioned no livestock anymore. How hard was that transition for you? I was just talking to somebody yesterday that said we had to keep the cows around, had to keep at least a few of them around, just couldn't stand to see them go. But you were able to do it. Were you forced to do it? Did your wife say it has to happen? Or is this something that you said, no, it's a natural transition for me?
Well, I was getting old. My cows were getting old. and I did not want to replace with $1,500 and $2,500 per head young breeding stock. Oof. It would probably be double that now. And then feeding $5.50 bushel per corn through finishing cattle took a lot of the fun out of it, and then it went to $7.50. So, no, it was not hard to free up those winters. Feeding hay when it was 10 below zero in a blizzard, and carrying hot water to thaw out cattle fountains. But what I do miss is those little baby calves in the spring when you see one born and you can take the little kids out there, grandchildren now, and see a newborn, you know, just stand and nurse its mother. I do miss that.
Yeah.
And that was one of the rewarding parts of a cow-calf herd.
Yeah, there's something about baby animals that is just amazing. I got lucky enough. I was driving with the kids when they were still pretty small, and we happened to be heading past a pasture, and I saw a mother cow, and I could see what was happening. She was about to give birth, and we just stopped the car. We were literally maybe 100 feet away from her and watched the whole thing, and the kids just thought that was the greatest thing in the world. But we haven't had our own livestock for a while either. That was a tough day for my dad hauling everything off, and at that point it was market prices that drove it too, and maybe that was a blessing for him at the time.
And back in the 80s and 90s, we went through some horrible times, horrible interest rates, and gosh, that beef cow herd. And then we also finished those calves, took them to slaughter weight. We were so close to the Tyson slaughterhouse that cow herd paid a lot of bills when the grain wasn't making the profit. So that they helped a lot when you're young and have a lot of energy. It's a good program to go with.
Yep, it sure was. Well, Rack, thanks for talking to us today. Really appreciate that. Good luck to you here. I know you're heading home soon. I'm sure things are going to look great, but good luck heading into the spring.
Great to visit you again, Darren, and hello to Janelle, and we'll talk to you again.
You bet. Thanks. It's Farmer Friday on Ag PhD Radio. We would love to hear from you. Love to hear what's happening on your farm, what you're thinking about going into this spring. We've got a number of email questions that have come in, radio@agphd.com. But we still have time for your phone call as well at 844-44-AG-PHD.
It's smart to make the right agronomic choices, and it's even smarter to get rewarded for them. With the Bayer Plus Rewards program, you earn cash back on seed, herbicides, and other eligible products. And it keeps getting smarter, because now you can earn an additional 10% bonus when you send your redemption check to your retailer. To learn more, contact your retailer today. Protect your yields and get the most from your land with Bayer Plus Rewards. Visit mybayerplus.com and see program terms and conditions for full details.
Nothing but net. Win your soybean season with the fast knockdown and lasting broad-spectrum control of Elevest Insect Control from FMC. Take on armyworms, stink bugs, soybean loopers, and more with the maximized ratio of premier active ingredients for better overall control of more than 40 labeled pests. Visit your FMC retailer or elevest.ag.fmc.com to up your game this season. Always read and follow all label directions.
For the smallest investment with the biggest impact on yield, upgrade your planter with Germinator closing wheels from Farm Shop MFG. To see how we stack up against the competition at a fraction of the cost, call us at 712-520-6051.
Get more durability for less downtime with Soil Warrior strip tillage from Environmental Tillage Systems. Improve fertilizer efficiency and reduce passes and fuel usage. Now that's ROI. Learn more about ETS at soilwarrior.com.
If you look close enough, you can see the hidden potential within your fields. That's why an agro-liquid nutrition plan starts with the crop and identifies the precise combination of primary nutrients while focusing on the support of secondary and micronutrients. So every nutrient is working in harmony for your crop to reach its full potential, maximizing growth while offering lower use rates. Apply less, expect more, precisely. Find an agroliquid dealer at agroliquid.com.
On your farm, you spend thousands on fertilizer every season. But how do you know if any nutrient you apply is paying for itself? Build a fertility plan like never before with Verify. With Verify's soil point to yield analysis, you can automatically see the connection between your soil test and yield data to see which fertilizer dollars will make you money and which won't. Go to verify.com to get started today. That's VRAFY.com.
Morton Buildings has served the American farmer for more than 120 years. From manufacturing our own building components to constructing your building, Morton takes pride in being the industry leader in post-frame construction by providing a quality building and exceptional customer service. A Morton is built to last for generations. To get started on your next project, please visit MortonBuildings.com.
It's Farmer Friday on Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm going to dive back into the radio mailbag here. We get so many different questions that come in, and it's kind of fun going through them, actually, because you know, you think about all the things you're thinking about on the farm, but it's kind of nice to hear from other farmers and what they're thinking about a little bit, and especially in different parts of the country and from around the world. All right, Brian, this question comes in from Wesley. He said, my family farms on Maryland's Eastern Shore. We've been organic farmers for 6 years, but for many reasons, we're switching back to conventional farming. So here's my question. Because we were planting in 30-inch rows to cultivate, we now have access to a 30-inch row planter, or we could go back to a traditional grain drill. So we're going to grow conventional soybeans. Which would you rather do, and which do you think gives you more yield potential, 30-inch rows or drilling conventional soybeans?
The drill absolutely gives you more yield potential, but you're probably going to have more disease that you have to be concerned about. So you want to try to pick the right variety. The other reason why I say the drill is going to be good for you is if you're conventional, then you don't have any weed control options. You need the best weed control possible. So yeah, if it was me, I would drill them in. Now, the only disadvantage to some drills, it all depends on what kind of drill you have, you want to make sure you get as many seeds to grow as possible. For example, on our farm, we used to use an old grain drill, and we'd throw out 250,000 seeds per acre. Well, you really only need about 140,000, but we had so many that we would lose just because the grain drill wasn't very good. Now, granted, that was 30, 40 years ago, so, I mean, seed was cheap at that point, but with as expensive as seed is today, you just want to get as many to grow as possible.
Hey, thanks, and good luck to you, Wesley, this year. I got this one in from David. He said, all right, guys, you were talking about Milo and grain sorghum herbicides, but you didn't mention Peak herbicide. That one used to be really popular. Is there a reason that you don't mention Peak?
Rotation. And the fact that it's an ALS. It's a sulfonylurea, but it's in that ALS chemistry or chemical family, and we have ALS-resistant water hemp, ALS-resistant kochia, ALS-resistant palmer, and others. So it doesn't kill a lot of the weeds we're really after, number one. But number two, that carryover thing, that can be a major issue. If you look right on the label to many crops, it's 22 months. So very concerning to me, because anything that says 22 months, I know very well that could be 40, 50, 60 months before I'm 100% perfectly safe to raise a crop. If, let's say, I have a couple of drought years or something like that, something goes wrong, my soil isn't perfect. So I have a lot of reservations about Peak, and that's the reason why we don't talk about it. And quite frankly, I've never recommended it ever.
Hey, thanks for the question. Thanks for checking out our content too, David. We really appreciate that. This one comes in from DS. He said, you guys were talking about the disease triangle, but wait a minute. Don't tolerant varieties make the pathogen problem even worse? Here's my thinking. Because the pathogen can still spread without impact to the tolerant plant, the non-tolerant plant will suffer even more. Only resistant varieties can really reduce pathogen potential in the field. At least that's what I've learned, but I'm curious, what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I remember reading this question a couple of days ago, and I didn't answer it because I wanted to think about it a little bit more. I could really see it both ways. I've never looked at any studies showing that that's true, what he's saying, or it's not true. But, I mean, I just think about human health, for example, and if somebody's tolerant to something, does that mean they're still passing it on? Maybe, but I don't think nearly as much because, well, anyway, the more a disease sets in, then the worse it has the potential to spread, I believe. So I don't really think that that's right, but it might be. So I'll have to do some more research on that, see if I can find anybody that's ever studied that exactly. But either way, let's put it this way. If day one, all we really care about is making sure that our field, our crop is as disease-free as possible, whether it's tolerant, resistant, you have to use a fungicide, I don't care. The point is we want to maximize yield. You've got to protect that crop somehow, some way. So that's number one. As far as how bad does it get in the future? Here's the other thing. We have one farm. I mean, we have multiple fields, but we have one farm. Okay, each farmer has their farm. Think about all the other farmers and all the other farms and fields and everything out there. So regardless of what we do, we're dropping the bucket to stopping a disease from blowing up in the future. So I guess I'm not that worried about it, but yeah, it would be kind of interesting just to see if there are any studies out there proving this one way or the other.
Hey, here's one other thing just to kind of throw a wrench in that. We see with diseases, we see with nematodes, there are other hosts out in the field, not just your crop. So if you planted a soybean field, but you have weeds that are growing in the soybean field, they could be a host for something else. So sometimes, yeah, maybe the soybeans aren't tolerant or are tolerant to a disease or a nematode or something like that, but other things out in the field may not be. So yeah, I don't know. I tend to think if you planted something that's tolerant, as long as it's not allowing reproduction on it, I don't think the problem's going to get worse personally. But that's a great topic to debate a little bit. All right, Steve had a comment. He said, you guys often talk about no-till versus strip-till, but if you're doing no-till, how do you deal with surface tension? I'm not sure what he means by surface tension, Brian. Do you think
I'm
surface crusting?
I'm guessing it's to get water to infiltrate. And can that be a concern? Sure. So, for example, like in golf courses, they have a lot of this issue. I'm usually not that worried about that in fields. But here are the two things that I would tell you we're really monitoring. Number one, calcium levels. We want to make sure our calcium levels are at least 65%. And personally, I prefer closer to 75%. That means your soil is going to be a little more porous. Also making your soil more porous will be higher levels of organic matter. So for our farm, we're watching our calcium levels. We're trying to do what we can to build soil organic matter levels, and then we don't really have an infiltration problem, regardless of whether we till or not.
All right, next question. This one comes from John, and he said, how is it possible that the water or liquid components of manure are a waste to haul out onto the land when you're converting manure to compost? You're giving up the water and liquid components. Are we losing something there, or is that something we should also collect and spread separately?
You are going to lose some water in that process. You can sure collect it, but I haven't studied that water in particular to see what we have for nutrients in there. What I'm told is that there isn't a lot, but I don't know for sure. So test it, and then you'll know. It's very inexpensive to send a water sample in and just see what's in it. And, my guess is it's going to be cost prohibitive to haul it to your field and spray it, and you're not going to get enough value out of it, but I could be wrong on that.
Yep, that's a great call out there. If you measured what was in it, then you would know. But yeah, for the most part, if you're going from manure to compost, one of the huge benefits is all that water weighs so much. So you've got a lot less trucking to get that product out as compost. But yeah, I've never really seen any study as far as what is in that water and is it worth putting out for fertilizer in the field. Speak about fertilizer. I got this one from IG. He said, I'm wondering, can we build up base saturation K levels by applying potash as a strip till band? And if so, what is the safest or what is the highest safe rate that I could apply in strip till of potassium chloride? We'll get to that question here in just a second, IG. Yeah, building up base saturation K levels is something we get a lot of questions about, but strip till is a little bit different than broadcast. We'll talk about what limits might be and give you a couple of tips there. But we've also got our phone lines open at 844-44-AG-PHD if you have a question and would like to call in. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Want a product that will give you nitrogen all season long? Then you want to try Envita. Envita gets directly into the cells of the plants, and it's easy to apply, foliar or in furrow. Envita provides the flexibility you need for your farm practices. Whether you want to reduce your nitrogen and maintain yield, or maintain your nitrogen and increase yield, Envita fits your farm. Envita SC formulation is OMRI registered. To learn more about Envita, visit azotic.com. That's AZOTIC.com.
Are you ready for better efficiency, more productivity, higher yields? Then you're ready for John Deere Precision Technology, which starts with three core pieces. First, a G5 display gives fast views of your work and a window to future technology. A Starfire receiver gives you sub-inch repeatable accuracy without an RTK base station. And a JD-Link modem gives you a live view of your entire operation. Get precise and talk with your John Deere dealer or visit johndeere.com/base.
Your farm data platform might let you manage your fertilizer plan by helping you set sample points, determine management zones, or create fertilizer recommendations. With Verify, you can do all that. But what Verify does that no one else can is take yield data straight from your combine, correlate this info to soil test points, and immediately generate variable rate fertilizer maps based on your nutritional goals. Whether you want to build soil levels, balance your field for uniform nutrition, or maintain fertility levels by simply applying what you removed at harvest. And with full integration with John Deere Operations Center, Verify can send recommendations directly to application equipment, no matter the color. Sign up for your Verify account today at verify.com and keep your farm moving. That's VRAFY.com.
The hard-working, independent spirit of rural America can often be isolating. It's not often discussed, but mental health issues are real. Now's the time to lead by example, talk openly, and show that a strong mind is just as important as a strong body. FMC is proud to be working toward ending the misconceptions around mental health through awareness, guidance, and action. Together, we can uproot the stigma.
Did you know soybean diseases like white mold and sudden death syndrome can survive in your soil even after rotating crops? Prevention of these diseases is a constant battle, and yield loss from an infection can be devastating. The right management plan makes all the difference. Keep your beans safe with Heads Up seed treatment. Heads Up guards your seed from both white mold and SDS. Stay protected and profitable by asking your seed dealer for Heads Up. Learn more at headsupst.com.
Farmer Friday on Ag PhD Radio. We're broadcasting from the Morton Studio, taking your calls and questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. Got a question here from Jake over in West Central Minnesota about applying manure ahead of soybeans. How you doing, Jake?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. What can we do for you?
So we're looking at getting some hog manure for the first time on our farm. And they were proposing to spread on both the ground that's going to be corn this spring and also some ground that's going to be soybeans. And I was just wondering, and they said that you're going to want to spread less where the soybeans are going to be because you don't want too much nitrogen.
Okay.
But they didn't really have a I don't know, they weren't willing to give a rule of thumb that they recommend. And what's too much, I guess? What could hurt the soybeans?
Okay, the biggest thing that we're looking for, number one, is always salt. So a lot of manure tests, unfortunately, don't even test for salt. So that's the number one thing. We just want to make sure we're never going above, say, 400 or 500 pounds per acre on salt. I don't care if it's corn or beans, but with beans, they are a little bit more sensitive to salt than corn. We've learned that firsthand, that you got to be careful. So I would say usually we're cutting it back by 20 to 40% when we go to soybeans as opposed to corn. Now, a lot of people worry about too much nitrogen and the beans are going to get lazy. I hear this phrase, and they're not going to nodulate. Oh, no, we put on the most manure you could put on safely with the salt and everything, and our beans nodulate just fine and the yield's fantastic. So I'm not worried about that part at all. But soybeans do need a lot of nitrogen, so it's not like this manure is going to waste. But nevertheless, like if we're limited on how much nitrogen or how much manure we can get from somebody, then it's always going in our corn ground first because we need the nitrogen worse in the corn, and we can apply a little bit higher rate safely. So those are kind of the general things that we look at.
Oh, okay. Do you worry about lodging or like with the that's what they kind of said was like lodging could be an issue.
Yeah, we always have to worry a little about lodging. So we're like on our farm, we have real high fertility levels now, and especially on the good ground where we have the high fertility levels in a good weather year, I mean, we'll get beans that are head high. And so we have to worry about lodging quite a bit. So our suggestion there is twofold. Number one, we want to make sure we have really high potassium levels. And manganese and copper are important too. But potassium is number one. So like in our operation, we're always looking at least 6% base saturation K in any of these situations. And then the other side of it is we're going to thin our population down. If we think that our beans are going to get really tall, they have a lot of nitrogen and all that kind of thing, then just cut the population a little bit. So normally we're planting 140,000, but we might cut her down to 100 to 120,000 in a situation like that. But if it's year one and you're not sure what's going to happen, I'm going to hesitate just a little bit before I'm cutting population and making all kinds of changes because we don't know. I don't know your ground. I haven't seen your soil test. I haven't seen the manure test. So I'm just talking in general here. So I just don't want you to jump to conclusions and say, oh, well, he told me I have to do this. So just kind of keep that in mind. Those are just kind of some general guidelines that we will usually follow.
Okay, very good. Yeah.
Our
potassium's probably 2% base saturation. So it's not great.
So that would be a major concern for me. So if I'm going to put the manure out and I'm going to have that nitrogen for my beans, because it'll take you a few years to build the potassium up, even using manure, to get to the level you really need to be. So I would for sure be cutting my population.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. And then the salts, I called Midwest Lab, and they were able to tell me how to calculate the salts from the analysis.
Oh, good. Okay.
They gave me because they didn't have it, and I was like, maybe I can get it out of it, and it wasn't too bad. So
good. Okay. Well, good. All right.
But
well, good luck.
I think that answers my questions. So.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jake.
Yep. See you later. Bye.
Hey, speaking of potassium, let's get back to the question from IG wondering, he's doing strip till. He wants to build up his base saturation K levels with potash. He's wondering what's the highest safe rate that he can apply in his strips.
Well, we don't know soil type. We don't know how deep he's going to put the K or anything else. So here again, I can't give an exact answer to this because I'm missing most of the information that I really need. But I'll put it this way. We don't love the idea of a massive build program in strips because it is possible to overload on salt. because everything's more concentrated and it's right where you're going to plant. So for build programs, that's where we typically talk about, let's look at a broadcast. Or if you want to be in a slight build program, you're going to put out 20% more than the crop's going to remove. Fine. You're probably not going to have a whole lot of issue there. What I worry about most is if somebody says, well, just like on the last caller, we're at 2% base saturation K, and we want to build it even to 4. Okay, well, that might require 500 pounds or 400 pounds of potash. Well, that's probably overdoing it. So I don't know. I'll say this. The heavier your soil and the more water you have, either in the soil or rainfall combination, with all of that, you could put on more. If you have lighter soil and you have less rainfall, then you've got to be a lot more careful about how much salt you're putting out. And basically, always keep in mind, fertilizer, by very definition, is salt. You've got a cation and an anion. That's a salt. So we always have to worry about what are we doing here with our fertilizer rates and how close is it to our seed and our young seedling, because it is possible and even probable that you are going to burn off some roots when your salt levels start to get elevated. So we got to be real careful.
KW over in Illinois has a similar question here. He said, I was listening to one of your shows you guys did, and you were talking about putting on build rates in the strip till, and then it's going to test high in the row. But if you're applying just removal rates, then it should be the same across your field. For soil testing. What type of application do you recommend for building soils across all nutrients? Our soil is 9 to 19 CEC, so kind of a medium textured soil, but we're rolling ground.
Yeah, like I was saying, we usually are going to recommend building in a broadcast. That way you can continue to soil test wherever you want. You don't have as much risk for overdoing it in the short term, because, I mean, we've done some what a lot of people call crazy things, super high rates of stuff. We've had almost zero issues out on our farm. And it's all because we're broadcasting those massive rates. So whenever you're putting big rates anywhere near the seed or seedling, you've got a lot more risk. And it's possible you can get by, but it's just like I often give the example of 1034-0. There are a lot of people that put out 10 gallons of 1034-0 and 4-0. I'd never even dream about that. But both Darren and I have been out on farms, and guys will say, well, I've done it for 10 years. I've never had a problem. Well, yeah, but you are at the high risk level every single year. So just because you got by with something once, and it didn't kill your crop or injure your crop, that doesn't mean you should continue to do it again.
Okay, got this one from RL about gypsum. He said, I've got high pH soil. What do you think of using gypsum in high pH soils?
Well, it's possible if you need both the calcium and the sulfur. If you don't need the calcium and the sulfur, then you don't want to apply gypsum. So that's all gypsum is calcium and sulfur. So is it possible it might work? Sure. But it's also possible that you may be wasting your money. There are a lot of high pH soils where they have poor drainage. They have high calcium levels already, and their sulfur levels are off the chart. Darren, you were just talking about one situation yesterday.
Yeah, I was just looking at soil tests yesterday. Same kind of situation. High pH soil, high sulfur, high calcium already, and the farmer had neighbors that were putting gypsum out there, and I just made the comment, I don't see what good it's going to do. You already have all the calcium and sulfur out there. It's like you already did put a whole bunch of gypsum out there. He had a drainage issue, and if he fixed that, that sulfur would do all the things that he's hoping the sulfur out of the gypsum would do, and flush some of those other problems like sodium in his case out of his soil. Hey, thanks for the question, RL, and thanks to you for listening today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.